This is the final episode of our look at monasticism in the Middle Ages. Now, to a lesser extent for the Dominicans, a bit more for the Franciscans, monastic orders were an attempt to bring reform to the Western Church, which during the Middle Ages had fallen very far from the apostolic ideal. The institutional church had become little more than a political body, with vast tracts of land, a massive hierarchy, a complex bureaucracy, and had accumulated both powerful allies and enemies across Europe. The clergy and older monastic orders had degenerated into an illiterate fraternity. Many priests and monks could neither read nor write, and they engaged in gross immorality while hiding behind their vows. Now, of course, that wasn't the case everywhere, but it was in enough places that Francis was compelled to use poverty as a means of reform. The Franciscans who followed after Francis were quickly absorbed back into the church's structure, and the reforms that Francis envisioned were stillborn. Dominic wanted to return to the days when literacy and scholarship were part and parcel of clerical life. The Dominicans carried on his vision, but when they became prime agents of the Inquisition, well, they monumentally failed at balancing truth with grace. Modern depictions of medieval monks often cast them as either, sinister agents of immorality or bumbling fools with good hearts but soft heads. And sure, there were some of each of those stereotypes, but there were thousands of sincere followers of Jesus who did their best to represent him. There's every reason to believe that they lived quietly in monasteries and convents. They prayed, read, and engaged in humble manual labor throughout their lives. There were spiritual giants as well as thoroughly wicked and corrupt wretches. After Augustine of Canterbury brought the faith to England, it was as though the sun had come out. Now, by the way, Augustine of Canterbury lived in the 7th century. He's not to be confused with the 5th century church father, Augustine of Hippo. Another among God's champions was Malachi, whose story was recounted by Bernard of Clairvaux in the 12th century. Stories like his were one of the main attractions for medieval people who looked to the saints for reassurance that some, at least, had managed to live exemplary lives while showing others how to. The requirement of sanctity was easy to stereotype. In the life of Saint Erkenwald, we read that he was, quote, perfect in wisdom, modest in conversation, vigilant in prayer, chaste in body, dedicated to holy reading, and rooted in charity, unquote. Now, by the late 11th century, it was even possible to hire a hagiographer, a writer of saintly stories. Such was Osborne of Canterbury, who for a fee would write a life of a dead abbot or priest in the hope that they would be canonized, officially declared by the church to be a saint. You see, there was strong motive to do this, because where there had been a saint, a shrine sprang up, marking with a monument his or her monastery, house, bed, clothes, relics. All were much sought after as objects of veneration. Pilgrimages were made to the saint's shrine, coins dropped in the ever-present offering box. But it wasn't just a church or a shrine that benefited, the entire town prospered. After all, pilgrims need a place to stay, food to eat, souvenirs to take home to prove that they had gone on the pilgrimage and racked up some serious spiritual points. So business boomed. Hagiographers included a list of miracles that the saints had performed. These miracles were evidence of God's approval. There was competition between towns to see their abbot or priest canonized because it meant pilgrims flocking to their city. Now, it was assumed that a holy man or woman left behind and the objects that they touched or the places they visited a residual spiritual power, a kind of merit which the less pious could acquire for divine assistance in their own troubles by going on a pilgrimage and praying at the shrine. A similar power inhered in the body of the saint and parts of their body, their fingernail, hair, such like that, which could conveniently then be kept in relic holders called reliquaries. People would then pray near or touch these reliquaries in the hope of a miracle, a healing, or help in some other urgent request of God. And the balance between the active and the contemplative life was the core issue for those that aspired to be genuine followers of Jesus and a good example to others. They struggled with the question of how much time should be given to God and how much to work in the world. From the Middle Ages, there comes no account of the enlightened idea that the secular and the religious could be merged into one overall passion for and service of God. In the medieval way of thinking, to be truly godly, a sequestered religious life was required. The idea that a blacksmith could worship God while working at his anvil was nowhere in sight. I think Francis came closest, but even he considered working for a wage, and the call to glorify God is mutually exclusive. Francis urged work as a part of the monk's life, but depended on charity for support. It wouldn't be till the Reformation that the idea of vocation as a holy calling liberated the sanctity of work. Because of the cloistered or sequestered religious life was regarded as the only way to please God, many of the greats from the 4th century on supported monasticism. I'm going to list now some names that held this view, trusting that if you have listened for a while, you'll recognize them. Anthony of Egypt, Athanasius, Basil the Great, Gregory of Nyssa, Ambrose, Augustine, Jerome, and, of course, Benedict of Nursia. In the Middle Ages, the list is just as imposing. Consider Anselm, Albertus Magnus, Bonaventura, Thomas Aquinas, Dun Scotus, Savonarola, and, of course, Francis and Dominic, who we've looked at over the last couple of episodes. The Middle Ages were a favorable period for the development of monastic communities. The religious, political, and economic forces at work across Europe conspired to make monastic life for both men and women a viable, even a preferred option. As is so often the case in movies and books depicting this period, yes, there were some young men and women who balked at entering a monastery or a convent when forced by their parents, but there were far more who wanted to engage the sequestered life who were denied so by their parents. When war decimated the male population and women outnumbered men by large margins, becoming a nun was the only way to survive. Young men who knew that they weren't cut out for the hard labor of farm life or military service, they could always find a place to pursue their passion for learning in a monastery. As in most institutions, the fate of the brothers and sisters depended on the quality of their leader, their abbot or their abbess. If she was a godly and effective leader, the monastery or convent thrived. If he was a tyrannical brute, it shriveled. In those monasteries where scholarship prevailed, ancient manuscripts were preserved by scribes who laboriously copied them, and by doing so, became well-versed in the classics. It was from these intellectual safehouses that the Renaissance would eventually emerge. By drawing to themselves the best minds of the time from the 10th well into the 13th century, monasteries were the nursery of piety and the centers of missionary and civilizing energy. When there was virtually no preaching taking place in churches, the monastic communities preached powerful sermons by calling men's thoughts away from war and bloodshed to brotherhood and religious devotion. Their motto of some monks was, quote, by the plow and the cross, unquote. They were determined to build the kingdom of God on earth by preaching the gospel and transforming the world through honest and hard, humble work. Monks were pioneers in the cultivation of the ground, and after the most scientific fashion then known, taught agriculture, the tending of vines and fish, the breeding of cattle, and the manufacture of wool. They built roads and some of the best buildings. In intellectual and artistic concerns, the monastery was the main school of the times. It trained architects, painters, and sculptors. It was there that the deep problems of theology and philosophy were studied, and when the universities arose, the monastery furnished them with their first and most renowned teachers. So popular was the monastic life that religion was in danger of merging with monkery in society of being little more than a collection of convents and monasteries. The Fourth Lateran Council attempted to counter this tendency by forbidding the establishment of new orders. But no council was ever more ignorant of the immediate future. Pope Innocent III, who presided over the council, was scarcely in his grave before the Dominicans and the Franciscans received full papal sanction. During the 11th and 12th centuries, an important change came. All monks were ordained as priests. Before that time, it was the exception for a monk to be a priest, which meant they weren't allowed to offer the sacraments. But once they were priests, of course they could. The monastic life was praised as the highest form of earthly existence. The monastery was compared to the promised land and treated as the shortest and surest route to heaven. The secular life, even the life of a secular priest, was compared to Egypt. The passage to the cloister was called conversion, and monks were converts. They had reached the Christian ideal. The monastic life was likened to the life of angels. Bernard said to his fellow monks, quote, are you not already like the angels of God, having abstained from marriage, unquote? Even kings and princes desired to take the monastic vow and be clad in the monk's habit. So even though Frederick II was a bitter foe of the Pope. As he neared his death, he changed into the robes of a Cistercian monk. Rogers II and III of Sicily, along with William of Nevers, all dressed up in monk's robes as they drew near their death. They thought doing so would mean a better chance at gaining heaven. I guess spiritual camouflage to get past St. Peter. Now, accounts from the time make miracles part and parcel of the monk's daily life. He was surrounded by spirits. Visions and revelations occurred day and night. Devils were said to roam about all hours in the cloistered halls. They were on the evil errands to deceive the unwary and shake the faith of the careless. Elaborate accounts of these encounters are given by Peter the Venerable in his work on miracles. He gives a detailed account of how these restless spiritual foes would pull the bedclothes off of sleeping monks and, chuckling, leave them across the cloister. While monasteries and convents were a major part of life in Middle Age Europe, many of them bastions of piety and scholarship, others didn't live up to that reputation and became blockades to progress. As the years marched on, the monastic ideal of holiness degenerated into a mere form that became superstitious and suspicious of anything new. While some monasteries served as midwives to the Renaissance, others were like Herod's soldiers trying to slay it in its infancy. As we end this episode, I thought it would be good to do a brief review of what are called the hours, sometimes the divine office or the breviary. This was how monks and nuns divided their day. The time for these divisions varied from place to place, but generally it went like this. In the early morning before dawn, a bell was rung that awakened the monks or nuns to a time of private reading and meditation. Then they all gathered for nocturnes, in which a psalm was read. There was chanting, and then some lessons from Scripture or the Church Fathers. After that, they went back to bed for a bit, then got up at dawn for another service called Lauds. Now, Lauds was followed by another period of personal reading and prayer, which resolved in the cloister again gathering for Prime at 6 a.m. Prime was followed by a period of work, which ended with Terce, a time for group prayer about 9 a.m. Then there was more work from about 10 to just before noon, when the nuns and brothers would gather for Sext, a short service where a few psalms were read. That's followed by the midday meal, a nap, another short service about 3 p.m. called None, named for the ninth hour since dawn. Then comes a few hours of work, dinner about 5:50, and Vespers at 6 p.m. After Vespers, the nuns and monks have a time of personal private prayers. They regather for a brief service called Compline and then hit the sack. Now, Protestants and Evangelicals might wonder where the idea for the canonical hours came from. There is some evidence they derive from the practice of the apostles, who as Jews observed set times during the day for prayer. In Acts chapter 10, we read how Peter prayed at the sixth hour. The Roman centurion Cornelius, who had adopted the Jewish faith, prayed at the ninth. In Acts 16, Paul and Silas worshipped at midnight, though that may have been because they were in stocks in the Philippian jail. As early as the 5th century, Christians were using references in the Psalms as cues to pray in the morning, at midday, and at midnight.